Tonight on Arena, composer and cellist Neil Martin on T.G. Cahir's feature documentary on his life and work, and actor Owen Macken on his new Netflix series, Ransom County. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Ransom Canyon is a new Netflix series based on the Jodie Thomas novels, set in Texas against the rugged expanse of Texas Hill Country. The series tells the story of three ranching family dynasties who are locked in a contest for control of the land. Things change when a mysterious cowboy arrives in town and stirs up secrets and threatens their very way of life. Ransom County stars Josh Duhamel, Minka Kelly, James Brolin, and our very own Owen Macken, who plays the Ivy League graduate and businessman Davis Collins, who wants to capitalise on the rich resources, I've lost my spot, of the area, but that doesn't sit well with the others, one of whom is his brother-in-law, played by Josh Duhamel.
I'm going to need a drink for this.
So, to what do I owe the pleasure, Davis?
You really gonna make me say it?
Well, I know it's not because you want me to sell my land to those Austin Water boys so they can build the damn pipeline, right? This is my home.
I know. And it'll stay that way. I'll guarantee a lease back. Nothing changes. Except you, me, and Cap will all be, several million richer.
Yeah, well, I don't need any more money.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, you inherited 60,000 acres in a trust fund, so.
Yeah, well, you're not doing so bad yourself, are you?
Staten, this be good for Ransom, for the town. Look, don't be so provincial. You gotta think about people apart from yourself for once.
You got no goddamn sense. The world's drying up. That aquifer feeds our wells, our crops, and our cattle, and I'm not going to let them run it dry. You understand?
Stan, the town has already granted permission for the pipeline. Now it's only a matter of time until I find a way, with or without you. Thanks for the drink.
There we have him, Owen Macken as Davis Collins and Josh Duhamel as Staten Kirkland. Brothers-in-law, they are there, fellow ranchers, and that is from the new Netflix drama Ransom Canyon. Delighted to be joined by Owen Macken on Arena this evening. Thanks so much for being with us, Owen. And you know, even as I listen to it there, he's some bio, that Davis Collins now. I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him, would you?
You can't trust him at all. You know, once you hear that kind of music coming in, you know, you can't trust somebody straight away, though, you know? Wouldn't that be great in real life if once you knew somebody was doing something nefarious, there's a little soundtrack, and you're like, oh, I can't trust you now. Hang on a second.
Yeah, unfortunately, the soundtrack is not provided in real life. It also it brings in, I think, it's fair to say, Owen, you know, I'm thinking of shows like Landmen or 1923, the prequel to Yellowstone, American Primeval. There's a whole host of them out there at the moment. Westerns seem to be having a bit of a moment. Would you put Ransom Canyon into a kind of a Western vibe?
Yeah, I mean it is a Western, and I grew up watching Westerns, so I mean I loved them. I used to grow up watching like Fistful of Dollars and stuff. So it was super fun to do a Western, and I think Ransom Canyon is definitely a Western, but it's got a little bit of a touch of that kind of Friday Night Lights kind of element to it. You know, so it's not quite as raw as a Western. It's got a bit more of a kind of character work going through it,
and yeah,
it's got that energy about it. You know,
and one of the things that you really get a sense of, certainly in the episodes that I've watched so far, there's such a sense of community here. Everybody knows everybody, which, as we all know, is sometimes a great thing, and sometimes a problematic thing.
It's just like being in a small town down the countryside, you know? It's like being down in Clare, but with ranches.
Well, is the land... Now, here's a hard one for you. Is the landscape more or less beautiful then in Ransom Canyon than it is in County Clare? Good luck with that one, Owen.
Yeah, you see, I pulled myself into that one, didn't I? Nothing can beat the landscape in Clare and Lochdurg, no. You know, it was amazing where we were shooting Ransom Canyon because we're shooting in New Mexico and it's, you know, that whole Route 66 vibe that goes through Albuquerque and its way into Los Angeles and stuff, it goes through New Mexico and you got those, the Jemez Mountains and where Georgia Keefe is and all her paintings and everything, and these landscapes are just vast, and you're driving out to these places to film and you're like, this is amazing, this is the kind of place you want to go and explore, but we were sort of shooting out here and it was pretty epic.
And you know, how much of a sense, how far away from a city or from a you know, a small town do you have to travel before you are literally in not quite the wilderness but certainly a very isolated area?
It's a couple of hours. You know, it'd be kind of like driving from, like, you know, Dublin to Cork and then just keep going into the ocean. And then, I mean, you realize when you're in Texas or in New Mexico, you realize how vast these states actually are. Like, these are huge places. And there's just so much land that just keeps going and going and going. The environment's massive, massive.
And we got a sense in that clip as well that the exploitation of that land and the resources of the land is a really important theme within Ransom Canyon, and it explains some of the difficulties, but only some of them, between Davis Collins, your character, and Staten Kirkland, Josh Duhamel's character.
Yeah, they kind of end up fighting over water and over women, I think. You know? So we're both fighting over Minka Kelly at the same time. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, the fight over natural resources is obviously a really big thing, and that's a really pertinent thing nowadays, anyway. And you kind of wonder even how will that fight over water become even more important the longer we go. But we do end up fighting over Minka an awful lot more than water sometimes, you know?
Yeah, and in fact, but it is just to stick with that environmental theme, because we often think of, you know, if it's going to be something in Texas, we're going to be talking about oil. But the fact that the emphasis shifted to water has a kind of a frightening pertinence to it. But you're right, most of the fighting is over Minka Kelly. And there's an interesting kind of difficulty of relationship here. Minka Kelly is the best friend of, as her character that is the best friend of Josh Duhamel's now sadly past wife, who was your sister. So there's a really difficult, you can see how the small town thing really hits in there. However, let us listen to a scene where I think this might be one of Davis Collins' best chat-up lines, certainly one that I want to check out with you, Owen Macken. Let's have a listen to the Josh Duhamel, Minka Kelly and Owen Macken all in action.
When?
Well, if it isn't Stan Kirkland.
In the flesh.
Better late than never.
When? Stan. Davis.
Great party.
What can I say? I'd do anything for my nephew. Look at you. New dress. Mm-hmm. Brings out the amber flecks in your eyes.
Thank you.
I'll leave you to it. I got a big birthday reveal in the works, so. The amber flecks in your eyes.
He was just being nice.
He's never nice, Minka Kelly. There.
I don't know if that line worked. The amber reflection I said didn't really hit home the way he wanted it to.
No, we should. We should explain that. So Minka Kelly is Quinn, and Satin, played by Josh Duhamel, and Davis Collins, played by Owen Macken, who's with me on the program this evening. Yeah, it's quite the line to have to deliver. Were there many guffaws, as you said, amber flecks in the eyes, or did you manage to do it deadpan?
I delivered it with the utmost seriousness. I was very earnest about it, you know. I mean, they came over for the party and her eyes looked great, you know. I mean, isn't that what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to compliment a woman on her eyes. I mean, you can tell by both of their hesitancy, it didn't quite go down the way he wanted to, which is why he exited pretty pronto. He's like, I need to go work on this one.
Yeah, and of course, what he does, and I don't want to give anything away, he's talking about his nephew, which is Josh Duhamel's character's son, and all hell breaks loose later on as a result of his big party reveal, as it were. I'm guessing as the series progresses on, does Davis Collins become more and more Machiavellian, less and less trustable?
Yeah, he does. He does. He's got his nefarious. Machiavellian is a very good way of looking at him. He's got a lot of nefarious kind of things that he does. But he justifies everything, you know, because I think the important part about any character who's doing stuff that's bad as such is that he's able to justify it in his own head. And so for Davis, everything he's doing it for his son and for his family and what he thinks is the right thing, or he's able to justify it that way anyway. But he is he's definitely somebody who is happy to run over you if you get in the way.
Yeah, which sounds kind of familiar in some ways to those who may remember you as the drug dealer Gavin Cuxton in Fair City. Not a man to be messed with either, it has to be said, Owen.
But again, he was a nice guy deep down.
Yeah, that is such an actor way of describing a character.
Well, you got to find a way of connecting to, you know, he's got to justify it, you know. I think Gavin Cluxton, he needed money to, you know, to buy a PlayStation, so he had a reason for it.
Yeah, okay, maybe not the best justification in the world, but
<I don't know.
laughs> yeah, I'll let you off with it. It's akin to Amber Flex in your eyes, but we let it go at this point in time. You had the big cinema debut then with Paul Mercier's Studs alongside people like Brendan Gleeson and Emmett J. Scanlon. But the big break, I suppose, in terms of moving outside of Ireland and moving into initially just across the small pond, was when as Sir Gawain in Merlin in the BBC series. You must have very fond memories of that time.
I did. I had that was an absolute blast to make. We were shooting out of Wales and playing one of the knights in Arthur's Round Table was genuinely incredibly fun, because we're riding horses and you're kind of sword fighting and doing the whole thing. And that show it's still got a great audience and a great kind of fan base all over the world, especially in Australia and Italy and England. So it was an honor to play that, and I had so much fun doing that.
Yeah, and I mean, a hugely successful series, which I guess in turn led on to then crossing the big ocean and the US medical drama Night Shift, where it ran for four seasons. A big American machine like that experience, I think, without putting words into your mouth, Owen, opened up a whole new world to you and a whole new way of seeing television and screen productions.
It did, and you know, and I think actually now the Ireland kind of has that equivalence in terms of the scale of production, because we do so many big shows that are also kind of American American type shows, and now shooting Ireland, which I guess is sort of has come into the country a lot more in the last 10 or 15 years, because the skill set of so many of the Irish crews and the producers are so good that it's on a par with that. And now everyone wants to shoot in Ireland, everything from, like, you know, all through Vikings and Ripper Street and all that type of thing. But when I did that show, it felt massive compared to even like working for the BBC, which was a really big show, Merlin, at the time. When we did the Night Shift, it was a huge show. And the scale and the scope of some stuff when they're doing explosions and you're kind of shooting these flashbacks in Afghanistan and thing, and they're blowing stuff up. Some of that stuff was just nuts.
Yeah, very, very big production size apart from anything else. And you do speak there like a man who'd be quite easily brought back home and tempted back home to do something. You were involved in Borderline. Is there Irish involvement on the production side of that? It's a Roku series, isn't it?
That was Shin O'Weill. We're still hoping to kind of go ahead and do a second season of that. That was a German finance, so ZDF. But yeah, no, we shot that. I was playing Northern Irish, and that was with Amy De Bruin, and we kind of we shot that in Dundalk just a year and a half ago. So I like to come back whenever I can and do stuff back home if I'm able to.
And there are lots of strings to the own Mac and bow, as it were. Apart from the roles that we've spoken a little bit about, some of them there, you write, you produce and you direct your own projects. And Christian Blake, I think, was one of your first features back in 2008. Yeah, that's a while ago yeah. Now. Leopard, Grey Elephant. Yeah, Leopard and Grey Elephant came hot on the heels of all that. And then in 2020, Here Are the Young Men. This was the adaptation of Rob Doyle's novel. Real study in toxic masculinity. Must have been interesting to look at how Rob Doyle was writing about contemporary Ireland in that novel.
You know, I love Rob Doyle's work, and I'd written a book called Kingdom of Scars, and myself and Rob were both up for an Irish Book Award for Best Newcomer, and I wanted to read all the other books in the category, and I read Rob's book, and I just thought his book was unbelievable at the time. And so Richard Bulger came to me, and he wanted to turn my book into a film, and I was going to say that we can't. I said, we have to turn Rob's book into a movie, because I just thought the way Rob writes... it's just so visceral, and I love the book. So me and Rob sat down, and we went for a compulsory few beers, and I was like, look, I really need to make this book into a film. And he was like, yeah, go for it. And I think we were a little unlucky when we made the film, because we came out just around the same time as everything was happening with COVID. So that year and a half, 2 years was a hard time for independent cinema. But I'm really proud of that movie. I think it was an important movie to explore kind of toxic masculinity and this just the choices that young men make and kind of just the pressures that they are. And I wanted to kind of do it, you know, with a soundtrack, The Chemical Brothers and Primal Scream, and make something really evocative. And I think we did that.
The music was such an important part of the novel as well that it was.
He's always referencing music through the novel as well, which is what he does really well in terms of evoking that sense of that sort of sense of emotion through his book.
One other thing, I don't know if you've had a chance to see, you've been so busy, you seem to be so busy all the time, whether you've had a chance to see Stephen Graham's Adolescence, which treats that toxic masculinity topic in a slightly different way and from a different angle, but a very important series that.
I did. I watched that from start to finish. That was brilliant. I mean, I'm a huge Stephen Graham fan, but I just the way that they shot that and they dealt with that, I just thought that show was incredible. And doing that whole show and kind of that one shot technique really kind of brought you into the world of what it was. It was really, I mean, it was terrifying at the same time, wasn't it? Just in terms of, you know, when you look at it so starkly like that,
it was terrifying in terms of fatherhood. Because that has been part of your added string to the own Mac and Bow. Recently became a dad.
I did. Thanks for ringing. Yeah, I've got a little almost 6-month-old girl, Bianca Leia. Yeah,
6-month-old. Are you getting any sleep yet?
I'm gonna tell you the honest truth. I get loads of sleep. Yeah, she this kid loves sleep, which is fantastic.
All right, I'll talk to you when she's one.
Don't say that. No, it's going really well. Don't say that to me.
One final thing, just when you mentioned Rob Doyle and the Borgar Share and Irish Book Award and the nomination back in 2014, have you continued, because you are writing screenplays, I know that, or you have been writing screenplays, have you continued with writing prose direct onto the page just for the sake of the novel reading itself? Has that continued in the background?
I have. I finished a book recently, just a year and a half ago. That's about kind of an Irishman coming back into Ireland and sort of dealing with sort of fatherhood and all that type of thing. Which is before I had a child. But before we published that, I'm actually working on a book about Cú Chulainn at the moment. So I'm currently sort of deep in that, and that's kind of the one that's something I really care about, and I really want to get that right.
And when you are writing those on, are you thinking in purely book terms, or does the screenplay start to crawl up the back of your head very quickly?
You start putting in stuff going, this would be great in a movie. No, it's a slightly different process. I find that writing novels, I just find is really cathartic and really enjoyable. I just grew up reading, and all I do is read in my spare time. So I love the process of writing books, just because of the whole world that you can create, which is bigger than even when you're writing a screenplay. So you kind of immerse yourself in a different type of tapestry, and you just kind of, you know, you let your imagination go wild. So obviously with something like Cú Chulainn, I'm trying to utilize the sort of stories that exist, but sort of, you know, put my own kind of twist on it. But yeah, you don't try and think about it in cinematic terms just yet, because you don't want to kind of put barriers on what the story can be.
Well, listen, lovely to speak with you, Owen, and continued success. Good luck with all the aspects of your career, and in particular with the all night sleeping that you're currently getting. You can report back.
Now I've said it. I'm done for. It's over now.
Owen, lovely to have spoken with you this evening.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Owen Macken, and Owen was telling us about Ransom Canyon, which is available to stream on Netflix from this Thursday, the 17th. Bohar and Hyol is a new feature-length documentary profiling the life and work of Belfast-born composer, producer and musician Neil Martin. The film follows Neil as he prepares for a special concert in Letterkenny to mark 25 years of the West Ocean String Quartet, a group known for its unique blend of classical and traditional music. The documentary looks at Neil's creative process, his collaborations and the key moments that have shaped both his life and career. It features contribution from family, close friends, long-time collaborators and including actor Stephen Ray and singers Mairéadh Ní Ónail and Jack Warnock. The film captures a year of reflection and celebration. And Tommy on with us, Neil, a vetting studio in Ocht, Gormil Bach, as Fahan Shot, August Falcher.
My good hymn.
It's Fahan wrote at Neil. I several times because I suppose we've soldiered on a few occasions together along the way. When you would talk about 25 years ago and 30 years ago, 25 years of the West Ocean String Quartet, but 40 years essentially of a career in music. That the shock of that number suddenly there being there in front of you, and then the process of stock taking. Talk to me a little bit about the emotions around that.
Well, first of all, what a great honour, you know, to have had a film made about one, an 80-minute feature doc. I mean, most people are dead before they get such like. So I was very, really humbled that the film should have been made. And of course, as you come on, there are certain landmarks that happen in all of our lives that mark things out. You know, when you get, you know, I don't know, I suppose when you finish your degree and then when you get married and then you become a parent for the first time. So all of those things have kind of marked out the life as well. But quite shocking, as I say in the film, was when a couple of years ago I got the junior bus pass that you get when you're 60 up at home in the north. And when that kind of arrived through the leather box, I was in denial.
The junior bus pass?
Aye. You get the full one at 65, I think. But the junior bus pass allows me to travel on public transport free in the north.
Right.
And then once you're 65, you can go across the whole island for free, as long as the Tory government don't pull that away from us next time round. Of course, they might well do.
All right. The junior bus pass. Now, there's a novel idea. I never knew of the existence of such a type of bus pass. You mix, and I'm sure this was a difficult choice to kind of to think about when it was Damien McCann, isn't it, who made the film. I'm guessing you had to work through, you've never particularly spoken about family. You've never, you don't pretend you don't have a family. Your wife and your children have always been part of who you are. Your parents and your siblings before that as well. But you've kept it separate, essentially, from your professional life. Was it a difficult decision to kind of think about how you would weave that in and out of the professional story?
Well, yes, I have kept those things separate. I see work and family as different things. But the director, Damien McCann, and myself have collaborated on a number of television series and programmes and so on before. So there was an immediate trust between us. And Damien said, look, is there any area that you don't want to talk about? And I said, no holds barred. And he says, look, if we stumble across something, you know, say no. I don't want to talk about that. So it didn't happen once, and we were kind of shooting on and off for 12 months. But it didn't even happen once where you were. I needed to say to Damien, no, let's not talk about that. So I was very much at ease talking to him, and I found myself saying this on camera without realizing. Kind of, I said, you know, I never talk about my family publicly.
Yeah,
which is exactly what I was doing in the film.
But I
think it was that ease of communication between the director and myself and the producer, Moira Vranach, and the whole production team. Yeah. The whole unit was it was a joy of a show.
August, it's the T.G. Cahir on Clower Show.
The T.G. Cahir August BBC
NI. BBC NI. Ach, on Bjognach on Time or Fod, thought it was a Glarich Osqueliga. Kek o thought it was a Visha Shin Ditcha?
In the Tamachtach, no, is given Lom Misha in a Wochel, Bedger Hart for 8 million a Dish no Rodden Chak, August, Heu Mahish Mahori. Go rang in a Gaelic mel first to learn a shaskadí. Nor if it's a concert jach, go lower there. So good.
Yeah, very good. It would be difficult. Yeah,
how could she the rash could you in chach August? Bon Roddy Bonasach, while at Copenthay, Corhogam and Shukra, Corhogam and Tharan, August Bagral and Golgaji, Afrin, and Gaelic Foster mel first. So Tasha Ste on a Mohus Mahail on a near your ass of Visha. Into Tawachtach and Lagan as far than Gaelic a Horchamach.
Yeah, and that is what you do. You spend most of the time in Irish, but very lovely Irish, I have to say, to listen to.
Thank you.
And also very easy to follow, I think, if you have the Cúpla Focal and anywhere there are the Faux Heddle are there anywhere for those who need them. You bring us through various moments in time, as you say, you know, those big kind of signposts in life. And there's a lovely scene, quite, I think we're a bit on in the documentary, in fact, when you go to your mother and father's home, you just walk up the street, then you go in, still have the key of the door, obviously, you go in through the door and you're looking around various pictures and things. And then you go over to the record collection and flick through some of the records that were there and you talk about how influential they were on you. And you pick out one particular record and you talk about this piece of music. To do that to JSB, Johann Sebastian Bach. But I mean, that opening Kyrie from the Mass in B minor, such a powerful opening statement in the choir. So clearly from, and by the way, the collection of records that was in your parents' house was very, very eclectic, it has to be said.
It was terrific.
But classical music, and particularly the music of that Baroque period, seemed to capture you in some particular way. Can you define what that capture was?
Well, I can now explain.
Yeah.
Back then, I knew there was something because the start, every Sunday morning, my father would play that piece of music that we listened to. He would lift the old record player out into the hall, play the Kyrie Eleison up at max volume, and my mother would make a fry. And that's how we woke.
So that was Sunday morning?
That was Sunday morning. And that promise, I promise you, that's my first memory of life. And I couldn't define it then, but I knew absolutely there was something, I couldn't put words on it, but there was something so extraordinary about that Bach B minor Mass. It opened up so many doors. I used to think of the B minor Mass in the same way as I would look up into the night sky and I'd see the moon and the stars. And when I was a kid, I would have a telescope. And there was something about infinity in the whole thing. And there still is that infinity with Bach's music. It's just...
Yeah, I remember hearing Maxim Vengerov playing a Bach partita just as an encore. An amazing concert. But he played this 2.5 minute solo violin piece at the end. And I thought, whatever the divine or whatever infinity is, I am there right now for this minute and a half. Similar type of experience that you're speaking about there. But I'm struck by the fact that it is Bach and it is that Baroque period, which is the moment at which, if you like, the music of the people, to put it, whatever that is, folk music we can call it, but the music that the people would have been singing and playing on the streets, in the taverns around Europe, became the music of the court, which is this interesting mix of your style of music between classical music, because that's there quite definitely in lots of what you do, but also traditional Irish music.
Yeah, well, the record collection, my parents' record collection set that all out. There was Seamus Ennis, there was Ray Cooter, there was the Beatles, Clockwork Orange, film track, Mozart, Beethoven, Bach. There was Louis Armstrong and the Hot Five, original Parlophone, Bakelite discs, all of that. There was just such a rich thing. that you were inhaling all of this music as a kid, and inevitably the cross-fertilization of various things came into your system somehow. And yeah, that's I think I was really, really, really privileged and lucky to grow up in that house with that music.
And then people might express it, you do play Eilean pipes, but your main instrument is the cello, which is certainly not particularly associated with Irish traditional music. But you are going to play a piece. You move over to the playing seat, as we call it. What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play a Callín na Grúg Idhinne, which is the girl with the brown hair. And I got this from Liam O'Flynn.
Right, Liam O'Flynn, the great piper. So Callín na Grúg Idhinne, Neil Martin making his way over to our performance seat now, taking up his cello and going to play live for us here on Tuesday Night's Arena. Martin playing live for us there, Callín na Grúg Idhinne, the girl with the brown hair on cello. And then speaking about Neil Martin this evening ahead of Bóthrán Sheol, new TG Cathair documentary. It'll be on TG Cathair this Friday, in fact, April the 18th. And as I listen to you playing there, Neil, you know, if I didn't know that piece, I could say, where does that come from? It's as much a classical piece of music as it is a traditional Irish piece of music. Was there the idea of playing the airs on the cello, did you get much resistance to that from either the classical side of the fence or the traditional side of the fence?
There was a bit in my teenage years, oddity about it. Some trad musicians said, because I could read music, I could never be a proper traditional musician. And some classical musicians looked down very much on traditional music as not being an art form as such. And I remember when I was a kid, 15 or 16, speaking to Micheál O'Sullivan about this. And Mick Sullivan said to me, let them batter away, ignore them. Ignore them. Just you go on ahead and do your own thing, do you know?
Yeah, and you certainly did that. And I suppose what guides us through the documentary in some ways is a preparation for a concert with the West Ocean String Quartet. Again, what you do and what you did with that particular quartet is quite extraordinary. Let's listen to a little bit of the quartet in action. This is Alistrom's March. The West Ocean String Quartet, Alistrom's March, Neil Martin. composer, arranger, whatever you want to call it, is of that tune there for string quartet, and it's, I don't know if it's actually featured in, if that particular track is featured in Bohor and Kiel. I think it is.
There's some of that in the program
at some point later on. Oh, yes, I remembered a little bit later into the program, in fact, as well. But again, displays that, you know, why confine any type of music to a particular type of performance?
Yeah,
the string quartet is, I suppose, could be held up as the epitome of classical music and the expression of classical music outside of the orchestra, you know, potentially the perfect form in terms of instrumental combinations. And yet there it is playing a totally traditional tune.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, I know something of classical music and I know something of trad music. And when you get into the space in between those worlds, you discover that place is limitless. It's, you know, I feel in some way that I'm only starting to scratch the surface of certain things, because when you get in and into that place, you can go any direction, you can do anything. You know, and I do it with the quartet, I do it in orchestral scores as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I love being in that space in between. I find it very enriching and very beguiling and very rewarding. I love it.
You were telling me a little bit before we came to air tonight, Neil, about your recent encounter with Wynton Marsalis.
Uh-huh.
I was so annoyed that I was unable to make that concert in March.
Yeah.
Wynton Marsalis in Dublin, how exciting is that? And then you get, well, you tell the story of how you end up being on stage with Wynton Marsalis.
I know, it was terrific. My eldest daughter, Maeve, is a PA to Nicola Benedetti, the violinist who is married to Wynton Marsalis. And when Nicky was saying to Wynton, and remember, Maeve's family are coming into the NCH, Wynton and Nicky had seen the film Bohor Hioil, and Wynton said, well, would Neil like to play something with us? So I played three jigs with Wynton Marsalis, and to hear jigs that one wrote being played by, I truly believe, 15 of the finest musicians I've ever encountered in any genre in my life on that stage was an amazing buzz.
And I guess, again, proving that suddenly there was these traditional jigs in a jazz a jazz idiom. There was no problem. The problem is in closing yourself off to that possibility.
Yeah, no, absolutely no problem. And the musicians of Winton's band and Wynton, they had never engaged with traditional music before, but very quickly they got into it.
Beautiful sections with your family and your four children, three girls and boy, Neil, the boy, and I can't remember the three girls. You better give the three names now.
Maeve, Sarah, Molly, August, Neil Og.
Yeah, Shin and Kathra Raku. Lovely section where they're playing together. You talk about the deaths of your parents and, you know, how you could accept that. That was the order of things. But I think the one that hit you hardest was the death of your younger sister, Noreen Abanande.
Yeah. Noreen died a couple of years ago, and that really blew a hole in the side of the tent, as they say, because you don't expect that. You don't expect a sibling to die in their 50s. And certainly you can't expect a sibling younger than you to die. Mm-hmm. So that was... But do you know, music is such a wonderful thing, and I'm so glad that we have this thing called music to express emotions at various times, celebratory times, but also at times of pain and loss. Music is a great medium, and to be able to have made that arrangement
of the Sally Gardens
and for the four kids to have played it at Noreen's funeral meant the world to
us. I will finish with something which links in. It's not the Sally Garden, I didn't want to pull that off the dock, because that's a real joy to hear when it happens in the documentary. But Queen in the Three, where it's though, tell us a little bit about this piece and how important it is to you.
This is an extraordinary song. It's one of the very few Easter hymns, a Paschal hymn in the Irish tradition, and I recorded this about 1990. Sean Corcoran and myself played in a band called Cran. And the words, some of the words in this beautiful song, you know, it's three Marys at the foot of the cross, and Mary, the Mother of Christ, says, "In ye shin and makin a jumper my three reiche, is that the boy that I carried inside me for three seasons?" It's utterly beautiful.
Father Aspel, walk to Mog Royal. Oh,
Sean Cochran, Cano and Shin, Queen and the Three were from the band Cran, as it was Neil Martin. Gormila Magath is fair.
Gormila he and Sean Gormila Magath.
That's Neil Martin, and the documentary we're speaking about, Bohar on Hiol, is on TG Cahir this Friday, April the 18th, and it will subsequently be on BBC Northern Ireland.
It aired on BBC a few weeks ago.
Oh, so it was on BBC a few weeks back, but it'll be on TG Cahir this Friday, April 18th. Claire Hennessy is a Dublin-based writer known for her captivating young adult novels, insightful storytelling, with a career that kicked off at a remarkable young age. Claire has written 12 celebrated young adult novels, showcasing her knack for crafting authentic, resonant narratives that capture the complexities of youth. Now she is stepping into new territory with her release in The Movie of Her Life, a collection of short stories that marks her debut in adult fiction. It's published by Deirdre Press and offers an unflinching look at the messy, haunting spaces between expectation and reality, delivered through sharp, voice-driven prose. Delighted that Claire Hennessy is with me in studio this evening. Expectation and reality, were those two things in your mind as these stories were written over a 15-year period?
Over about 15 years, yeah. So it's been a really long time in the making. Mm. It's very weird now suddenly to have them kind of all out in the world.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, it's funny actually, because listening back to you kind of, you know, saying there's quite nice things about the book, I'm kind of nodding along going, God, that sounds very good altogether. Did I write that? Exactly, yeah. Because when you're writing them, and particularly I think with short stories, you're writing them in kind of these kind of intense bursts, and you're not necessarily conscious of what you're actually doing when you're in the middle of it, you know, and it's only maybe sort of afterwards that you kind of look back and sort of go, right, I suppose, yeah, there's maybe kind of some kind of similar kind of themes going on there, or, you know, I'm maybe sort of, you know, returning to kind of to certain kind of issues or kind of ideas. But I think when you're in the middle of it, it's very difficult to speak intelligently about it. You're just typing away, you know.
Yeah, you're writing the stories and seeing what comes out and seeing what's never going to see the light of day.
I presume there's an awful lot of that. There's an awful lot of that. Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose to go back to the idea of, you know, expectations versus reality, I suppose we were thinking a lot about that in relation to the title in The Movie of Her Life, which actually came about quite late in the process. So I'd been working with the publishers, Dira, who are absolutely sort of brilliant. And we'd been kind of thinking about, you know, sort of different kind of ones. And I sort of was going through the different things going like, God, there's actually, I think I've accidentally put in a few recurring themes here, you know. And one of them was, I suppose, that like state that we all kind of live in now, really, which is that we see so much of our kind of lives, I suppose, mediated through kind of screens, you know. I mean, even like me, you know, sort of on my way in here today, was there kind of going like, oh, must get a photo of this, you know. And we're exposed to so much more of maybe sort of aspirational kind of content, you know, because it's not just kind of celebrities in glossy magazines being airbrushed, right? It's people that you know and people that you work with and people that you encounter posting kind of highlights of their lives and kind of seeming to just be always living their best, most optimized life, you know. Whereas I think, you know, inside, I think so many of us are kind of stumbling around going like, Jesus, I'm doing everything wrong. I'm messing up all the time. I could be entirely wrong here. There could be people listening going like, no, Claire, actually, we're all getting on grand.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that title story then.
Sure.
In The Movie of Her Life. Young woman with a fellow who wants to be a comedian.
A fellow who wants to be a comedian, yes. Well, you know, if you make it a writer, it's a little on the nose. yeah, so, I mean, that one kind of came about, I suppose, you know, again, this is me intellectualising after the fact. But I am really interested in that kind of, I suppose, tension between making creative work and kind of doing the sensible thing and, you know, sort of pursuing kind of maybe sort of more stable work.
Yeah.
And I suppose as well then kind of maybe relationships and how they are sometimes unequal. And I think in the case of this story...
Very politic of you to put it that way.
And in this story, Connor, the boyfriend, he's a bit of an idiot. And I mean, the response is really interesting from readers, actually, who've kind of taken a look at it, whether in this version or kind of an earlier one, because, you know, sort of half of them are going like, I do not understand what she is doing with that fella. And then there's another half kind of nodding and going, yeah, I've known a Connor. I've been with a Connor. I'm glad to be out of it, but I do understand that.
Can I ask you then, how gendered is that? Are those responses? Because I must say, I looked at it several times and I was going, Lucy, the girlfriend, Lucy, would you stop? He can make his own cup of tea.
He should be able to. Yeah. I mean, I think he does definitely have that kind of learned helplessness thing. Mm. Let's do the obligatory. Not all men.
Yeah.
Not
all women.
And not all women, indeed. Well, I mean, there's kind of a flip side actually to that kind of story later on, which is a couple moving in together, and it's the girl in the relationship who's completely useless at the domestic stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't deliberately sort of do that kind of for balance, you know, as though there was some kind of, you know, referendum coming up and we needed to have it equal. But I am, I suppose, kind of aware that you don't want to be just trotting out the same kind of, you know, tired old kind of cliches about, about kind of, you know, men and women and sort of different, you know, like all that kind of stuff. We're more nuanced than that. Yeah, you know?
Absolutely. Because the other interesting thing is when Lucy gets into her job, when she goes into the office, isn't it her, or am I mixing it up with the first story in the book? Now, you can correct me if I am mixing it up with the first story in the book, where she kind of is the best girl in the office. She's doing everything she's told.
She's a good girl, yeah.
In that case, you're saying, yeah, I was shouting at the workmates, would you stop? Would you let her be? You know, and kind of empower her in some ways. You know, and it's good to get that kind of visceral response to something you're reading.
I'm delighted that you had that response. Yeah, it's it's really difficult to kind of to see any of these stories kind of clearly, really, because you know you do spend kind of so much time kind of looking at them and at a really sort of like micro level. You know, so I worked with. With Lisa Frank at Adira, and she's kind of a writer herself as well as kind of being an editor, and she just had this like just has this like amazing kind of eye and really sort of good at kind of going like, yeah, do you know, like you've saying very nicely, you know, the things like, yeah, you've kind of, this might be a bit much, you're hammering the point home, you know, you're getting up on your soapbox, which I am known to do, but I think in fiction you do need to pull back. And you know, sometimes you're getting down to the level of like, should this comma be like a semicolon or should it be a dash? And at that point it's really difficult to kind of step back and go, oh right, yeah, the characters and like the other stuff that's going on.
Yeah, am I telling a story here?
Yes, because you know you're trying to do that. You know, you are trying to do that.
Just on the subject of, you know, 15 years, as we say, in the making of the story, I'm wondering how, because there are some of the stories are, you know, classic, I suppose, classic 7-8 pages, short story length.
Yeah.
There's one, Knitting, which is it's a bit of flash fiction. It's two paragraphs long.
It's 100 words.
Yeah,
can't believe I got away with that, quite frankly, you know.
But I wondered, you were writing your hugely successful young adult novels at during that time as well. In some ways, did this book or these stories, had they some kind of function within your writing life, like a break from the novel that you were stuck on for whatever reason, or you know, no, I just want to try something else that it may never see the light of day, but I just want to do this for myself this morning.
I think a little bit of all of that, definitely. I'm a big believer in, you know, I do spend kind of part of my time doing kind of mentoring and sort of, you know, working with kind of other writers on, you know, on their own kind of craft.
You know the name of it better than I.
Well, in a variety of kind of places now. But one of the things that I do kind of always say, and I think it's kind of useful to kind of to keep in mind, is that when you're working on like a big project, like a novel, you're going to get fed up. You're going to be, you know, you're going to sort of find yourself maybe kind of a little bit kind of disheartened with it. I always compare it to you know, running a marathon, even though I have no experience of that. But people seem to run with it, so I'm just, you know, pun intended. But you know, so I'm going to go with that kind of comparison. But I think, yeah, it is kind of nice to have maybe sort of a shorter piece that you can kind of be focused on, and something that you can complete a first draft of within a shorter space of time. Yeah. And I mean, and I want to emphasize there kind of like first draft, because, you know, you might well be sort of coming back to it, as indeed I was with some of these, coming back to it years later and still kind of improving and kind of refining it. But yeah, I think in general, like I am in favor of the idea of stretching yourself a little bit kind of creatively. You know, I mean, I also have been kind of dabbling in poetry, for example, which is at a much, much kind of earlier stage. So maybe in about, I don't know, 40 years, we might see something. We might see something there.
But it links into that title of the overall collection, In the Movie of Her Life. I mean, I guess you did those things because you didn't want to be in the movie of Claire Hennessy's life. You wanted to actually be in her life, doing those little things. And by the way, Big Smoke Writing Factory was what I was trying to find.
Thank you.
In my pages, which is the writers group or a work set of workshops.
Creative writing workshops, yeah.
That you set up in 2008. There are, you know, and you have a great kind of energy and sense of fun about you, but there are some very dark and upsetting stories in the novel, in this book as well.
Yeah.
And one which really caught me was the 17 worries.
Right,
which
yes.
is 17 bullet points. May I read the last four or five?
Please do, yeah.
So this is, it's gone through the 17 ways, you know, how you know you're in a toxic relationship, a bad relationship. And number 13, that you'll never breathe easy. 14, that it'll happen again. 15, that everyone knows. 16, that he'll leave you. 17, that he won't. And it struck me when I read those, as indeed even earlier on as well, so much happens between each of those bullet points.
Yeah.
Yeah, how much paring back was there? You know, so much. In other words, in the story of this person, there's space for the reader to think, what happened between that it'll happen again, you know, and that everybody knows? What happened in that woman's life?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think part of it was, and I mean, it's funny because it's a very short story as it exists in the book. And it was a very short story when I originally sent it to the publishers, and it was pared back even further. And again, I would credit Lisa for that, for having that kind of understanding. I think with, you know, with a number, I suppose, of the topics in this book, they are, you know, they are sort of, I suppose, the terrible things that happen very often mostly to women or entirely to women, depending on which one you're looking at. And I suppose with this one, what really kind of struck me, right, was that if we are in any way kind of aware, we know that story already. Don't we? Do you know, we know that those relationships exist, and we don't necessarily, it might sometimes feel maybe sort of, you know, gratuitous, or it might feel kind of heavy handed to be, you know, actually sort of going into kind of a tremendous amount of detail about the specifics of it. You know, we can fill in those gaps. We have seen those relationships. We might have been in those relationships. This is not something kind of strange and alien to us. And I suppose, you know, like, I'm always very interested in, you know, sort of writers that can do a tremendous amount with very kind of pared back pieces of work. And I mean, I don't know necessarily if I always achieve that myself, but I aspire to it, you know. Yeah.
Was it a very different, did you think differently in terms of these, as I say, very successful young adult novels, and then writing this for potentially some of the young adults who are now grown men and women?
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, you know, I do think there is, I mean, I do think there are kind of, you know, some people who sort of, their version of kind of young adult fiction is kind of, you know, sort of quite outdated, or kind of, you know, very much limited to, say, like, you know, one particular sort of genre, or maybe sort of, you know, thinking about, like, you know, sort of like, you know, series fiction or like book packaging or you know, anything like that. And it's like, no, it's a much more kind of complex and rich and interesting kind of field of writing that intersects with all these other kind of fields. And I do still quite enjoy getting up on my soapbox about that.
And also, some of us older adults might learn something from reading some young adult fiction.
Well,
things we didn't learn as young adults.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it is. It's interesting how, you know, sort of people that I know that are readers and are writers and some of them have read my work for younger readers because they're kind of going like, I'm still allowed to read it. And others are going like, oh, finally, a book for us.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, these are stories that are, you know, some of them are about teenagers. Some of them are, you know, kind of 20s, 30s, 40s. You know, so that kind of like first half of life, I suppose.
Yeah.
There's... I wouldn't say so much it was maybe sort of thinking so much about the intended age.
Yeah.
But I mean, certainly, like, you know, there are elements like, say, you know, worrying about like the Dublin rental market, for example.
Yes, it's
you
not
know, that's not
a little
something
bit further
that's
on.
you can't really sort of be doing that in YA.
You could do other things in this. Claire, absolutely. Fascinating to speak with you. Congratulations
so
on the collection. In the Movie of Her Life is what Claire Hennessy has been speaking to us about. It is published by Deira Press. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was in sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reggie Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. Apologies to John Clunan, who will be with you after the news.